Hello and welcome to another episode of Pakistanomy. My name is Uzair Yunus, and joining me once more is Khurram Hussain. Many of you are familiar with Khurram. Khurram writes for Dawn, is a business journalist, somebody who frequently comes on this podcast when I need answers about things that are ongoing. And this was an important week and will be another series of developments that will be important in the coming days in Pakistan. So I figured it was important to have Khurram back on to talk about this. First of all, Khurram, welcome back to Pakistanomy, and I hope you're doing well.
Doing well, and thanks for the invite to have me back on again.
So let's start with, there's been a few developments, and I want to go in order, right? So let's start with monetary policy. Then we'll come to the Saudi-Pakistan investment conversation that's ongoing, delegations coming, investment talk going on, some reports about even PIA being on the docket as part of a deal with the Saudis. And then we'll come back to the IMF because budget is coming up, a tranche has been released. But this week, obviously, the state bank decided to not change interest rates. A lot of conversation happened around that. And I know you have a point of view, but I was listening to the former finance minister, a common friend of ours, Dr. Miftah Ismail, who was on Geo. And he seemed to believe that not changing interest rates was not the right choice, that the state bank could have reduced it by at least 100 basis points to give some additional confidence to industry and businesses. But one of the interesting things in that he said was, look, you could have negotiated this with the IMF. But I think this was the first time ever where he had been critical of the governor of the central bank. Basically, he said that he has no credibility and therefore he couldn't ask or make his case in front of the IMF for why 100 basis points was merited. Obviously, the business community is unhappy with high interest rates. A lot of conversations saying inflation is coming down. So, you know, you have even higher real rates in Pakistan right now. How did you see the state bank's decision and what they said in the monetary policy statement?
I was not surprised at all with the monetary policy decision. And if you read the IMF's statement, that was the statement that was released right after the executive board approved Pakistan's last review of the ongoing standby or not the now concluded standby arrangement. You'll notice in two places, not one, but two places in that statement, first by the staff itself, and then secondly by the deputy managing director itself. They mentioned that interest rates should stay where they are. The staff itself, their language is a bit more, shall we say, diplomatic. They say the monetary policy should continue to remain data-driven and realistic. If I recall the words correctly, I'm calling from memory. The deputy managing director is more direct. He just says they are fine where they are. So they're saying it not once, but twice. And, you know how things are done in Washington, D.C., where these statements are released. Every single word is pored over before it is released and made public. These are not sort of shoot from the hip or frivolous words, usually. They are weighed very carefully and before they are made public. So there you have it, right? The IMF itself saying, forget about rate cuts, okay? You find your interest rates are fine where they are. Your monetary policy is fine the way it is right now. I think what Miftah Ismail was saying on the show that you mentioned is a sentiment that is held largely by the business community in Pakistan, the sort of the big owners and controllers of capital who are probably the first in line to be hit by rising interest rates. Their balance sheets are the first to be hit. Government is obviously the largest entity that is hit. I think in terms of how much that hit hurts, it's probably the business community. It hits them harder and hurts more because, you know, they're not dealing in trillions the way that the federal government is. And most of the pre-monetary policy surveys that I saw, if not all, I think most of them were seeing more or less a split. People were saying 50-50. Some were saying no cut, some were saying there will be a rate cut. And then in the 50% saying there will be a rate cut, there was like, okay, this many saying 1%, this many saying 2%, whatever, something like that. And I've got a feeling, because I spoke to some of these business community people too, that many of them were sort of making the mistake of thinking that their view is the state bank's view. And they make the view pretty well over here that there is no longer a need for interest rates to be at 22%. And the latest inflation number that has come out at 17%, they're saying, look, we told you so. We were right. And from here onwards, the high base effects kick in because May last year was the peak that interest rates had hit their peak. So May of this year, the growth rate from last year is going to be even less than 17% in all likelihood. The underlying drivers of inflation are seem to be coming under control. The monetary aggregates are, by and large, staying within bound, barring a few movements here and there, but they do seem to be staying within bound. The exchange rate appears to be, by and large, stable. What's now the need to continue going like this? That's the argument they're making. Clearly, the state bank doesn't see it that way. There, the most basic thing to understand here is that the monetary policy in Pakistan is not made at the state bank anymore. It used to be, and I think it can, it still is in times when there is no IMF program that the country is trying to implement.
So
But so long as the country.
that's a pretty big statement you're making, Khurram, that the institution that supposedly got increased levels of autonomy a few years ago and independence, we've talked about this on this podcast, you and I have had long discussions among others on the way in which that bill was passed, but that's history. So now instead of the sovereign, which is the federal government in Islamabad and Q Block in Islamabad in particular, dictating to the IMF or to the state bank what needs to happen under certain conditions, you're saying that it's Washington DC that is now dictating to the
Look,
IMF to the
look.
central bank.
Here's how it's actually working now, right? At least during the period when the standby arrangement was being implemented, the IMF team would come to Pakistan. They would hold their consultations first in Islamabad, where with the federal government. Then they would hold their meetings with the State Bank team, and they would go home. They, to my knowledge, did not hold meetings where both of these guys were present, except in those in the more sort of final rounds. And with the federal government, they basically looked at the fiscal and the circular debt and those outturns. With the central bank, they sat and looked at the monetary movements and decided on interest rates and exchange rate and the net in, the monetary movements on foreign exchange liquidity as well as rupee liquidity. And then they would go back and they would tell both of these parties, this is what you need to do, this is what you need to do. And that actually gave the state bank over here a little bit of leeway and plenty of autonomy. Because if the sovereign went to the state bank saying, hey, you need to cut interest rates, they would say, that's not what the IMF said, right? They said, don't cut interest rates. So we're leaving it the way it is. The state bank did not want to be, neither one of these parties wanted to be the guy that snags the review, right? So their interest was in just saying, look, this is what the IMF said. I'm not going to snag the review. We're going to do as they said. If you think we should do otherwise, you persuade them to tell us otherwise. That's the sort of dynamic that was going. Now, you've been sitting in on the post-monetary policy announcement briefings that the State Bank gives. And a lot, we've both been in those, along with over 100 other people. You tell me, how convinced are you that the State Bank actually knows and understands everything that it's doing in terms of, the conduct of monetary policy and how the aggregates are moving, what justifies a rate cut and what doesn't? Because not that long ago, we saw them looking at very similar situations and justifying low interest rates. Now we're looking at the same state bank looking at these aggregates justifying high interest rates. To me, having sat in on these over a period of time, I just see a central bank that's like doing what it's told and then inventing the story, right, to justify their particular action. But they're not really making the decisions. They're mostly just weaving the story and the narrative around the decision that has been told to them.
No,
that
I
issue.
fully agree with that, Khurram, and I think that's been the key issue, right? So where I agreed with Dr. Ismail was the credibility of the central bank, in particular the governor of the central bank, because ultimately the buck stops with him. And all of these briefings are exactly that way, right? Like it's like the headline is written first, and then you go conveniently find the facts that help you tell that headline story. And that's been the issue. I think that's why there's a credibility gap that I think is the most fundamental challenge to the central bank. And we will see where it goes in relation to that. But I want to talk about another related thing about this, right? Because this is, again, Dr. Miftah Ismail raised this, but it's a conversation you've heard, I've heard many times, is that, look, the interest rates being high leads to a problem on the fiscal deficit side. That then has a cascading effect in terms of OMOs and the liquidity injections that have to happen on the central bank side to allow borrowing. And if you actually reduce interest rates, it eases the fiscal deficit burden, reduces the OMO size of the scale, reduces the challenges we're beginning to see on the commercial banking side because they're the lenders to the sovereign. And oh, by the way, like it's not like higher rates and a higher burden will force the sovereign to cut its spending. So it's actually a good idea to reduce rates by a little bit. Like, how do you see that as an argument, right? Because that's again part of the business-oriented argument, among others, has been that look, like cut rates, the deficit reduces, everybody's happy, doesn't do much on the other side, but actually improves stability in the system.
There, I gotta confess that I don't really, I no longer understand the economics behind how interest rates and inflation connect with each other here in Pakistan. To some extent, yes, as you mentioned, the liquidity injections, the monetary aggregates move in a particular way that is going to be inflationary. That in a sort of a very broad general sense, we can see that. When there's an explosion happening in the monetary aggregates, you can see and then and say, okay, inflation is coming down the road. But when those are coming under control, then how? My hunch is that the high interest rates right now are being maintained more for the foreign exchange liquidity side rather than the domestic inflation. But that's not an area that the State Bank wants to or can talk about because in these very same briefings that we are talking about, the holders of Pakistani debt are present. The bondholders and the foreign creditors, they're listening very carefully to everything that is being said about the foreign liquidity and the functioning of the FX markets. So the State Bank tends to be very sort of they tend to talk about that in very cursory terms, paint a fairly rosy picture, and keep the focus more on the inflation, the CPI. Then they show us the heat maps and the disaggregated things and all that. I've got a feeling much of that is just sort of like, narrative
I
building.
think this time, if I may interrupt, what stood out to me, I want to see if this stood out to you as well. They did point to higher rates in advanced economies and the fact that rate cut cycle has slowed down, which made me immediately think of two things, right? One is the carry trade, the reversal of flows. If you cut rates, right, so you have actually disincentivizing inflow into Pakistan because of the carry trade phenomenon that would emerge as a result of that divergence. Doesn't happen right now for various reasons because of Pakistan's credit ratings, but still plays a role in the bond market thinking of Pakistan. But more importantly, that has a direct connect with the exchange rate. And as a result of that exchange rate pressure, you have an inflationary environment issue that could emerge because you're diverging from advanced economies, which are maintaining, like the Fed is maintaining rates right now. And it's changed the view here in America about the pace of rate cuts has evolved over the spring going into the summer. So did that stand out to you? Because that particular point stood out to me this time around about the central bank sort of diplomatically talking about why they need to maintain higher rates for this exact reason that you were alluding to in
Yeah.
portfolio management.
No, I gotta admit, I think there's a conversation we need to have there. I can't claim that leapt out at me. And I have in the past seen them actually also point to international interest rate, global rate, when they were cutting rates in the wake of COVID, for example, when they were maintaining low interest rates for what, something like well over 18 months or something like that, up until September 2021, right, from June of 2020. So that's about what, 2 years or more than 2 years, in fact. During that time too, they kept pointing to what's happening on the global front with interest rates. So, I mean, now that you mention it, maybe there's something there. But to my mind, I just sort of racked that up next to narrative building. I said, you know, this is something that they often do when they're looking for reasons to justify why they undertook a particular action. Then they reach to things like, well, in the international markets, this has happened, this is what international central banks are doing, and stuff like that. So I just racked it up
Okay.
as that, just like.
All right. I want to move to the next topic here then, right? Which is obviously a lot of conversation going on, delegations coming and going, lots of talk about airlines and privatization, things like just Saudi Arabia. A lot of people are skeptical because that Saudi investment talk has been done so many times about the refineries and the billions and the mines and everything else. But I gotta admit, like in the last few weeks, momentum has indeed picked up. The delegation flow and the conversation has gone to a level that at least I am paying more attention to this time around. And I would love to get your thoughts on where and how you're seeing the broader conversation with Saudi Arabia and PIF in terms of assets in Pakistan and whether or not there are enough deals to be done here and is progress being made related to these deals with Saudi.
I'll draw your attention to one key fact, one thing that has struck me really hard over here. Two meetings between the Prime Minister of Pakistan and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia in less than 30 days. Now, that sort of thing doesn't happen. These are not courtesy calls, and that sort of thing doesn't usually happen, if there isn't a good reason for these meetings to be happening. And then, of course, one looks at the more sort of subtle diplomatic protocols that are also being revealed in these meetings. For example, I'm told, I don't, this is not something I'm going to stand by to the nail, but I'm told that meeting with a delegation that has come for Umrah, whose official purpose is Umrah, is not normal. Like the royal fam the you know the highest levels of government will not meet with a delegation that's there for Umrah purposes. But they met with the Pakistani one. And I'm told the fact that the first meeting showed the Pakistani delegation wearing the ihram, that was a signal. That was a signal saying that we're special and this is special. And they're going out of their way to meet with us. There's a departure from standard diplomatic protocol taking place here. Now, again, I'm not standing by this. This is not a hill I'm going to die on. But those who watch diplomatic affairs tell me that there's something there. That is actually signaling taking place over there. In addition to that, I draw your attention to the fact that the first meeting takes place, there's a visit by the Saudi foreign minister, sorry, accompanied by a large delegation. And then there's a release of a statement, a rather strange way to release a statement. I believe it was first released on his LinkedIn page. And I'm forgetting the name of the Saudi official right now, but the one who heads their investment fund. The statement was long, it was detailed, and it talked about, you know, there are all these investment possibilities and whatnot. And this state a statement coming from the Saudi side for the first time that we were seeing. After that, we have another visit with and meeting with the Crown Prince. And this time followed by a large number of another delegation, large delegation, again, operational people. Now, we can say, okay, these people are not very senior, they don't have an interest in PIA. I don't know what the details are, but I can tell you that these kind of contacts usually mean something is up, that something is being worked on. These are not courtesy calls and these are not exploratory visits at the end of which they'll say, okay, well, we came, we looked, and we didn't really find anything. See ya. Right, they're trying to make something work. They're trying to look and together go through the whatever they have before them, and they're trying to come to some kind of an agreed upon outcome. I don't know what that outcome is. I'm not even saying that that outcome will be a good thing for Pakistan or anything. I'm just stating a fact here, right? That this has happened. It appears like this is happening. I would take these contacts more seriously than many of my more skeptical friends are, because I think something's cooking. And the other thing, two other things make me believe that. Number one is the larger geopolitics, the realignment that is taking place. You know more about that than I do. But Blinken's most recent visit to the region that where he was there, the World Economic Forum, and the kind of conversations that happened over there. Again, I think your viewers might know more about that than I do, but for my part, it's enough to just note that some kind of a geopolitical push in the region is taking place. And somehow there is a realignment going on. Where it's going, whether it will succeed or not, I don't know. But in the course of that realignment, the bigger powers, especially Saudi Arabia, are reaching out left, right, and center to see who they can bring in as a partner on their side in this. Right, so that's happening in Riyadh, and at the same time, there are these contacts happening with Pakistan. And here in Pakistan, you've got a government that's who I and I'm increasingly convinced their number one problem now is how do we break the Imran Khan fever that has gripped this country? They're almost obsessed now. Other than maybe, Shahbaz Sharif and some of his other people, but I think at the higher levels, there's a great deal of concern that how do we deal with Mr. Khan? And now that he's gone ahead and written this article in the Telegraph saying that, well, it looks like the only thing left now for them to do is murder me. They failed in really breaking my will, breaking me and whatnot. They can't release him. They can't. They're having a hard time now pushing ahead with the trial. They don't quite know what to do. One really good way to break that fever is to give the country a year, 2 years, or maybe 3 years of sustained high growth, right? If you manage to get some inflows coming in, enough to pump growth one more time of the sort that we've seen in the past, in the mid-2000s, we saw it in the mid-2010s, maybe we'll see it again in the mid-2020s, maybe, right? Then, one can plausibly say that given 3 years of high economic growth, with money being made all around, employment opportunities proliferating, business activities sort of leaping to life, and the current moribund state of affairs suddenly sort of being left behind, the exchange rate stabilizing, inflation stabilizing, once all that begins to happen, I think a credible bet can be made that the Imran Khan fever will begin to break. And that will give the government some space in which to then do what they want to do. So over here, domestically, there's that. In the region from where these delegations are coming, there's a realignment taking place. And as evidence, we have a pace of contacts that is unusual. Now you can trace the timeline further back. I'm just looking at the timeline from the past 30 days. We've had two visits with the Crown Prince, two large delegations, 30 days of. You can trace it further back. we've had the Saudis provide a rapid deposit to Pakistan, if you remember, when this current standby arrangement began. And that was also when Shahbaz Sharif had met with them. That was when everybody was saying, well, they're no longer in that business. They're no longer in the business of providing deposits. A $2 billion deposit suddenly shows up, and then another billion from the UAE. Coupled with $1 billion from the IMF, and our foreign exchange reserve suddenly went from $4 to $8 billion in a month, right? And Pakistan pulled back rapidly from the absolute brink of a catastrophic default. At $4 billion, we were less than a month worth of import cover. Suddenly, that doubled that figure. Something's up, how far it'll go, what shape it will take, whether it'll be good for us or not, I'm waiting to see that. But I would urge people to take these contacts a little bit more seriously. And let's keep an eye out to see, what exactly, what shape does it take?
Yeah. Yeah, I would add to the geopolitics of this. I think that's a key driver. And there are two things that I'm watching out for, right, Khurram, is one, following the Iranian sort of response to Israel's attack on its consulate in Damascus, there is a real conversation in the Gulf in particular, but across the Middle East, including in Jordan, that if the Iranians have this capability to send drone swarms and missiles across, then our security is also at risk. Like, what's preventing them from doing the same onto Dubai, right? Dubai doesn't have the Iron Dome or David's Sling in the way that the Israelis do. And I think my view on this always has been that if the Gulf in particular, given Iran's capabilities and growing capabilities in the kinetic domain, needs some level of protection, then that potential protection comes from across the Persian Gulf, across the Arabian Sea into what is Pakistan. That obviously are things that won't be openly talked about in Pakistan, but if you follow geopolitics, that's the obvious way to have an early warning and detection system about Iranian capabilities. And of course, that links back to the fact that prior to this high level or during this high level engagement that you were referring to with the Saudis, the Iranian president was also in Pakistan. And there have been tensions with the Iranians as well. People in this entire context of Israel and Iran forget that the first country to attack Iran on Iranian soil since the Iraq-Iran war was Pakistan a few weeks ago, after their attacks in Balochistan, right? So there is that dynamic playing out in the region. That's one. And I think the second that I sort of like feel that in the mainstream discourse in Pakistan, people aren't catching on to or not paying enough attention to is the fact that a few months ago, the Arabs and the Indians and the Europeans and the Israelis came together to announce IMEC. And IMEC is supposed to connect the Indian part of the Indian subcontinent, the Western seaboard in particular, through the Gulf into Israel and into Europe through energy corridors, transportation, et cetera. And of course, part of the push from the UAE in particular, but to an extent from the Saudis, has been encouraging Pakistan to find a path forward with India. And they've been doing the same to the in Delhi as well, but more so on the Pakistani side. I think these are all connected, in my view. I'm speculating, there's no information here. But if I were to just look at the chessboard and say, okay, if the United States's goal is to lock out Iran and China in particular from the Middle East, and they're pursuing this broader normalization, which Saudi wants to be a part of. Saudi's extracting security and economic guarantees from the United States as part of this agreement. Israel may or may not sign on, but the Saudis are signaling, hey, if you want to come along, sure. And that's been the conversation in Western press increasingly. People like Tom Friedman are saying Bibi needs to choose between Rafah and Riyadh, right? And the Indians want to be part of this corridor because they see there's an opportunity here. And I think on the Pakistani side, there perhaps is a conversation that ought to happen about whether or not there's an opportunity here for Pakistan as well, given its historic ties with the Gulf and the fact that, as you said, they bail out Pakistan more so than anybody else. Of course, the environment we are in Pakistan, I don't see an open conversation about this, but that's what I'm monitoring from a geopolitical standpoint on this.
Right. No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And the IMEC part, again, you have people far better than me to talk the geopolitics of all this with. I'll simply leave it at this. I think we both note that geopolitics is now in play, and very, very, in a very large way. I mean, Saudi Arabia is talking of a large security umbrella from the United with the United States. These are massive developments, and absolutely, and Pakistan is caught up in them. And evidence of that is the Iranian president visits shortly after that, the Saudi foreign minister visits, then the South Pakistani prime minister is visiting Riyadh and meeting with the crown prince. something's up, something's cooking, and I think in our country, a moribund economy has always been restarted on the back of geopolitics. I mean, there's maybe one example in the early 90s when I wouldn't say restarted, but there was sort of a growth impetus imparted to the economy through fetching foreign inflows in the form of resident foreign currency deposits and other kinds of borrowing. I think at that point in time, maybe geopolitics was in the back seat, and I wouldn't call it reform, but nevertheless, organically grown economic policies at home were the driving force for the economy. But in the early 80s, the restarting of growth over here, in the 1960s, definitely in the middle 2000s and the middle 2010s, all of these growth spurts were geopolitically driven. I think given that geopolitics are at play, we have a history of starting a moribund economy with geopolitical inflows. There's a massive political incentive at home to get the economy going in order to overcome the single biggest political challenge facing the government. All of these things are just pointing towards the fact that something may well be up, and I'm waiting to see what it is. Fortunately, I'm not in the business of breaking news. I don't need to sort of rush to the leading edge of all this. I'm perfectly fine. Kick back, wait, and see where this goes. But just make sure you read the signs accurately when at the time when they are taking shape before your eyes. And I would take these contacts, and the frequency and the high levelness of the contacts, seriously.
No, fully agree. And I think the last point I'll make on this before I ask you my last question is, in the last few weeks, we've seen a major deal between the Emiratis and Microsoft on AI. And that was geopolitically brokered as well. The push was from the US government and the Emirati government to say, look, if you want to be part of the tech ecosystem of the United States, you got to commit to divesting from and not going in with Chinese technology. And that's where Microsoft came in as part of the deal, which is leading the AI boom on the Western side right now with OpenAI and everything else. So that was another econ side interesting. Again, you got to read the events in that sense and see what's going on. Last question on this, Khurram. Obviously, the finance minister was in Washington. IMF conversations went well. No major negative uncertainty type headlines came out of this, which my view always is, and I think you will agree that when the breaking news is no breaking news, when the finance minister is meeting the IMF, that's good news. That's excellent news. It's a double thumbs up to his performance, I would say. But one thing I've sort of been monitoring is that, like many finance ministers of the past, he's also an incrementalist. There's not going to be major structural changes to the economy. There's no vision but what we often hear from him is, and you've written about this, is we know the what and the why, we just need to do it. And of course, the budget is coming up. What are you looking for and what do you expect to come in the next 6 weeks or so, given a new IMF program is needed, given they're talking about privatization, and given that at least, and if you disagree, I would love to hear your thoughts, that this is another incrementalist finance minister as well. What comes next here?
I think the privatization part they are serious about this time around. And we're seeing some pretty serious movement happen. I'm not seeing any serious opposition to, for example, privatizing PIA. Even every government has tried to do this other than the PPP government of 2008. Okay, they had a different idea. But the PPP has historically not
And
supported
Bilawal is still
privatization.
talking about it, right? Public-private
He's still
partnership.
talking about it, and TV anchors here in Pakistan are making a big deal, saying, "Oh my God, a big coalition partner is opposing the program. It's not going to happen." I was like, "No, man, it's just a statement."
I think
And it was
what
a
was
statement.
interesting, if I may interrupt on this, because Miftah talked about this and I was chuckling when he raised this. He was like, if you keep 10% shares in PIA as the government and privatize the rest, that's also a public-private partnership. So I was like, that's actually a good catch by Miftah saying you can still do a public-private partnership by largely privatizing PIA and being a minority shareholder as the government of Pakistan.
I mean, look, it can be done in any number of ways. But I think by now the opposition to privatizing PIA has pretty much collapsed. It is ringing true when the finance minister says by June we'll have this done. They're already, there's news coming out, consortia being formed. The business community here is lit with rumors of who's partnering up with whom. Two names have already come forward, Arif Habib, and who was the other one in that Bloomberg story just now?
Jerry's group, right?
Yeah, the Jerry's group, huh? There's about half a dozen other names floating around in WhatsApp groups. The fact is that all this chatter denotes that there's that interest is forming. They've asked the government, can you delay the deadline for the submission of expressions of interest, which is a request that's been complied with. And they're talking to each other. Again, what emerges, let's wait and see. On the tax side, I'm a bit
Quick on
skeptical.
before you go to tax on privatization, do you see potential for distribution company privatization after PIA, or that's
Yeah, I
going to be too
do.
difficult?
I do see potential, but right now it's not on the anvil. Right now the focus is on PIA. I think that may come after. Depending on how successfully PIA goes off, I think the first of the distribution companies that will probably be put on the anvil if they decide to go that route will be the Faisalabad Electric Supply Company. That's always been seen as the sort of the juiciest of the lot. The lowest sort of line losses in that, you know, the easiest recovery, the least sort of problematic in terms of recoveries, and then they would, but I think it is conceivable, especially if the PIA one goes well. But on the tax side, I'm a bit skeptical. I think they may succeed in getting traders to pay something through the electricity bills and that sort of thing. But it's unlikely, I think, that they'll get the, you know, we've just seen one effort to try and voluntarily get people to come and become filers, you know, and register to pay their taxes. We saw that fail. It didn't really draw much of a response. It never does. I think any effort to try and turn them into actual filers of income tax returns is going to be stymied. But if you come at it indirectly and say, okay, well, we'll just tack on a certain fixed withholding tax in your electricity bills and the car, you know, which was Miftah Ismail's old proposal as well, till it was killed with a tweet by Maryam Nawaz. Something like that could well come back up again. And this time, you know, we'll see whether it gets killed with a tweet or not. But you know, other than that, I think I would expect a fairly bread and butter IMF program. I'm not expecting that the first year targets are going to be as tough as they were in 2019, for example. Some of the hard work required has been done in the standby arrangement. Some remains. I don't expect a program as tough as the 2019 one or the 2008 standby. You know, one that straitjackets the government that heavily. I'm not expecting something like that. And if they do get something mobilized on, mind you, as well, you know, this one thing the State Bank governor pointed out, 2 trillion rupees of accumulated state bank profits are going to be made available to the federal government as soon as the fiscal year ends for the next fiscal year. That's a lot. And that will also provide them with a significant fiscal cushion for fiscal year 25. And in addition to that, if they unlock at least some revenues from some inflows, I shouldn't call it revenues, but some proceeds from privatization. And more importantly, if they manage to offload the liability that PIA has become, and liberate themselves from the obligation to keep bailing that company out every few months, that will provide some fiscal cushion. And then let's see what shapes up on the geopolitical front. So there, in a nutshell, I would say I think that, you know, the movement in privatization as the sort of the avatar of the structural reform effort, it feels real this time. And I think as far as the stabilization is concerned, a large part of the heavy lifting has already been done. It will be tight, the situation, but nowhere near as bad as it was in 2019 or in 2008 or even in
Got it.
2000.
Got it. Last question. I know you don't like speculating, but I have to ask you this because it's a fun question in my view. How long does the finance minister last this time around?
Again, I think a lot depends on how things turn out. If he manages to get a decent fund program, if he manages to show some success in the early success, score some success in the privatization effort, he's got to generate some headlines. That's something that Aurangzeb has to do here.
Positive headlines, I would say. Headlines can be.
Positive. That's what I meant. That he's got himself to produce and give the country a few headlines. That here's something that has happened, not the kind of headline that says we are going to do this, but here's something that has happened, and sort of establish himself as a real live newsmaker. That will help cement his place in the cabinet. And of course, he can never take the place that Dar has among the party rank and file. The party MNAs and MPAs will still go to Dar in order to channel their requests to Aurangzeb. But he can sort of compensate for that by producing some results in other areas. It seems like he's doing work in order to bring that about. Let's see. Again, it's too early to really make a call on it right now. But I think if we see some headlines coming out from Aurangzeb's side within the month of May, in the run-up to the budget, then I think we can say that he may well finish the fiscal year that he's about getting ready to open. But if he doesn't, if we're into July and we don't have any big headlines that we can attribute to him, then we might want to start counting the months.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Khurram, as always, pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your insights. And, I think the big stuff to watch, I agree, is the PIA privatization and how the IMF negotiation, the budget goes. And I think so far, the finance minister has said the right things. We'll see what he can pull off in action. But when the action starts happening, I'll have you back on. But in the meantime, thank you so much for your time.
Look forward. Thanks very much.